Hello, and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comics podcast at AIPTComics.com. I am your co-host, David Brook, and with me is Forrest Hollingsworth, as always.
Hello. You may know me as Forrest with two R's. You may also know me as the most bald man in comics. That's right, Lex Luthor. That's right, Xavier. My head is so squeaky clean.
Do you shine it?
I should.
Does Bruce Willis shine his head? Who knows?
Bruce Willis knows.
These are questions that won't be answered on this show because this is the show where we talk about comics. And on this very special episode, we have Dennis Hopeless, with quotes, Hallam, on the show to talk about Spider-Man City at War and other Spidey projects. This is all in celebration of Spider-Month, which was a huge success, I have to say.
Winning!
Forrest curated, edited, and was the man behind our Spider-Month, our spectacular Spider-Month. And Dennis was gracious enough to be on the show and answer a few questions and play a little game with us. If you keep listening, you can get there to the part where we have the segment where Dennis comes on.
The part where Dennis do talk better than us.
Yeah, exactly. But before we get there, we're going to talk about the news. We're going to talk about the latest news in comics. And at the top of the show, we are going to be talking about San Diego Comic-Con, which is a place I was at last week for all four days? Was it 4 days? I don't know.
Yeah, 4 days.
Yes, I was covering it for APTComics.com. Some highlights of my week were talking to Joe Hill about Hill House Comics, his new horror line at DC and DC Black Label. I got to talk to a lot of folks like Karen Gillan about his new Boom series and also about X-Men, which you could have read if you go to the X-Men Monday post that was posted on, you guessed it, Monday. Overall, it was a good San Diego Comic-Con. I did think it was busier than ever. Thursday was a crush, dude.
Interesting.
Usually, at least the first two Thursdays, I've gone, this is my third year, it wasn't that bad. And then Saturday was the day where you could literally get suffocated to death on the floor. That was a bit of a labor to get through, because especially because DC moved their booth to the back where Funko is. Meanwhile, all of the main comic publishers are like at the center of the warehouse style floor, right? Convention floor. So I had to get from a Boom interview to a DC interview, and it was like, should I just ride these people like I'm at a music concert? But yeah, some other takeaways that struck me. Hasbro ran out of their toys. They're exclusives.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Like, I wanted that Boba Fett so bad, and I was like, it'll be fine. I'll just go on Sunday, because the last 2 years, they were like, there was no line on Sunday, and they had everything.
Hmm.
Not the case this year.
Interesting.
But there was some huge news. I mean, movie news. This isn't a movie podcast, but movie news. Holy crap. Marvel is killing it, huh?
Yeah, Phase IV.
There you go. IV, I like it. I need that in my veins.
Yeah. Yeah, fucking Blade, dude.
Oh, my God. Blade? And what, that casting?
Yeah, Jesus. Oh, my God. Did you hear about that? Mahershala called Kevin Feige?
I heard it, but I didn't believe it.
I'm really excited for that in particular. I'm also really excited for Mighty Thor, played by Natalie Portman.
I loved, I always pronounce the director's name wrong.
Taika Waititi.
Yes. When someone, like, they wrote on Twitter, like, this is Woman Thor or Lady Thor or something, and he said, yeah. No, correction, it's Mighty Thor.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's badass. Like, you right there, you know he gets it. Even though he admitted he doesn't read comics.
Yeah.
He gets it. He gets the
I
point.
Almost wonder, is that the most recent thing to get adapted to the MCU?
Ah, good question.
I think there's some stuff, Kelly Sue DeConnick, Captain Marvel stuff that may be more recent. But it's certainly up there in terms of like recency, turnaround time.
Well, the funny thing is Lady Thor has been in comics for so long, right? Like she's been Thor for, 5 years or something?
Yeah.
That it's almost not new, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
But there was also some comic news that came out. DC has a really cool Harley Quinn book coming out that is, Harley is a like investigator and she's tracking down Joker. It's obviously like an Elseworlds tale. I got to see that panel where she, Cammy Garcia is going to be writing that.
Cool.
I was at the panel, also who was there was Scott Snyder and Jeff Lemire, but she went into in-depth detail about like how she is, it's like basically a CSI type of story, And Harley is like this very smart detective type, and she's tracking down Joker. But she went into like, Cammy was going into how like her father, you know, this was his actual career. And like she grew up with her father teaching her how to get out of a trunk of a car, how to get out of taped like hands and legs. She's very passionate about it. So that's really cool. And then Jeff Lemire is obviously doing his own Joker series with Andrea Sorrentino. That's going to be really cool. It's funny, I'm more psyched for DC's, like, Elseworld not canon stories.
Yeah, I think they're finally leaning into Black Label in a big way.
For sure.
And that makes sense. Like, they've got to consolidate everything, and while they're consolidating everything, make the case for Black Label's continued existence.
Right.
So, I would imagine, too, that they're waiting for stuff to come in before they marketed it. I think that that's a good play, but I also, like... The first couple months of Black Label were pretty weak, and all of a sudden it's like Jeff Lemire, John Carpenter, a fantasy series, like all sorts of stuff that's like, all right, now I feel invested in this.
Well, Carpenter's doing a Year of a Villain book, but I mean, he is a big name, which you don't usually see DC do. It feels like that's a Marvel play, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's much more of a J.J. Abrams writing Spider-Man type thing, but
Jesus. Is anyone excited for that, like for real?
I think the villain looks cool. Also,
I mean, Nick Lowe is.
Also, at the Spider-Man panel, Nick Lowe said he's been trying to get JJ to write Spider-Man for 15 years.
15 years.
Admittedly, I was a little like, why? He's not a writer, man. He's a director.
Well he did. Didn't he co-write the pilot to Lost?
I think so. And I think
that was 15 years ago.
He wrote some of Alias and stuff, so maybe that stuff came out.
But you're right. Like, he's not known for writing.
No, not at all.
I think he's, I like to equate him to like Spielberg in that I think they're good idea men.
Yeah.
But they're not writing like full screenplays and then producing them like someone like Tarantino.
Right. Right. Absolutely. The biggest announcements though were the X-Men books. And you were there.
Yes. I was. I was at the panel. It was at the Next Big Thing panel, which is, you know, at this point, 3 years running, it is the biggest panel of San Diego Comic-Con. I'm sorry, DC. I'm sorry, Image, Dark Horse. It, like, they're just really good at giving you art to look at, giving you covers to look at that has never been revealed before, and get people like talking and, you know, buzzing. And at this panel, they had Jordan White, they had Jonathan Hickman, obviously Nick Lowe was there too. Nick Lowe was there too. He was a game show host.
CB.
And you know, it was funny when they came in, everybody was like, X-Men, and they were like, okay, we're gonna talk about Ghost Rider for 5 minutes.
yeah I mean, that's a good play though. I think that
for sure,
by the time they started announcing X-Men stuff, like, for one, I was watching on Twitter and Twitter blew up, but also like, I can't understate how excited I am for some of these books, if you want to get into them real quick.
Like, oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. It was just really quick. They did a game show style where they revealed the title of the book, then they revealed the creators on it, and then Nick Lowe went out to the audience and pulled two fans, and they guessed what the mutants would be on the teams.
That's cool. Yeah, that's fun.
And then they would reveal the team, and then they would reveal the cover art, and they did that for every book. And there are 6 books.
Yep.
So I was live tweeting every step of the way, all these steps, and my phone had so many notifications. My phone couldn't keep up. It was I've never seen anything like it.
Also, a much better idea than having people put on Black Widow and Blade hats, by the way. Cool as the MCU Phase 4 looks, I was like, hats?
Yeah, okay. And very odd, too, because you can't really see it from afar.
This is really, really cool, and I think obviously pretty exciting for the fans that were in the room, but also for everyone else.
Yes, because not only are a lot of the mutants dead... and some of these books revealed they're not dead anymore, but also some major titles like X-Force number 1, which will be written by Benjamin Percy with art by Joshua Cassara. This is a cool team. What do you think? Do you like this team?
I am pretty into Joshua Cassara drawing it.
Yeah.
He did some work on the recent Colin Bunn written Web of Venom Funeral Pyre. The absolute carnage tie-in, and it's so cool and dark and scary. So I'm really excited for it. I'm also pretty intrigued by Jean Grey being on this team. I don't think Jean has ever given official respect or deference to X-Force before.
Right.
So that's really interesting. I'm also really into the idea. The solicit says the X-Force is the CIA of the mutant world, one half intelligence branch, one half special ops. Beast, Jean Grey, and Sage on one side, Wolverine, Kid Omega, and Domino on the other. So that's really, really cool, I think.
That's a cool idea for sure. Yeah. What is the deal with Jean being in the old costume?
So that's interesting. Yeah, she's gone back to the Marvel Girl name and costume. My best guess for that is that Hickman is trying to keep her away from the Phoenix. I think he wants to tell a Jean Grey story, not a Phoenix story.
I love that Wolverine's in a brown costume again.
Yep. On this book, at least.
Yeah, on this book.
I also love Quentin Quire. I love Kid Omega. I know he's an asshole.
Yeah.
But he's a great character, and I think people definitely like writing him because of that. So that's really cool.
I think one of the coolest things about these books, it's getting people talking because of the, you know, the dynamics of all these characters, some of which are villains on these teams.
Excalibur.
Excalibur is another book that's been announced, and that's by Teeny Howard with Marcus Toe. Apocalypse looks really gung-ho to do some good.
So I think that that's probably the biggest holdover from the Age of X-Man event, is that Apocalypse is now a good guy. Maybe he just loves fucking. I don't know. But
he's going to be back on that love train.
Yeah, so this is Jubilee, Richter, Rogue, Betsy Braddock as Captain Britain, not as Psylocke.
Very interesting.
And then Apocalypse as well. And Gambit.
And Rogue is in her old costume.
Yep.
The 90s costume.
So Rogue and Gambit on a team is a good idea, obviously, coming out of Mr. and Mrs. X. Having Teeny Howard write this book, having Teeny Howard write a queer character, Richter, all very, very good. The fact that Mahmoud Asrar is doing the covers for every issue, like, all right, sold, done.
They're definitely putting a little more weight into it, probably because it's a little less popular these days. Excalibur, I mean, the title.
I would have said that at the beginning of last year, but I've been really, really surprised by how many creators say, like, hey, Marvel, if you ever want to reboot Excalibur, I'll write it. I'm into it. And JDW, Jordan D. White, the senior editor of X-Men, has been wanting to reboot Excalibur very publicly for a long time.
Right.
So, like, it's obviously a bit of a passion project. And I know Teeny is really, really excited to write it, too. And I don't think there's a single thing she's written that I don't like. So I'm really excited for that.
Are you excited for Marauders by
Jerry Dugan and Mateo Lawley, cover arts by Russell Dodderman?
Yes.
I think, no disrespect to Mateo Lawley at all, this is a weird artistic choice, and we'll get to another one, Fallen Angels, which is also strange to me. I would really, really love to have Russell Dodderman drawing the book.
Of course,
And I think he probably will in Wave 2 be writing an X book, or drawing an X book.
But yeah, typically the main artist is doing the covers, so.
Yeah. This is an interesting team. Iceman, Storm, Kitty Pryde, Bishop, Emma Frost, and Pyro. So a weird team, and it says that they're going to sail the seas of the world to protect those hated and feared, which I guess the concept of makes a little bit more sense after reading House of X, but still, I'd love to see how we get all these characters to be pirates.
I wonder if they'll have a flag. I mean, you can see there's a sail on their boat, but there is a skull in their name, Marauders.
Also not at all the actual Marauders team, it's just the title.
Right,
because the Marauders were originally a kind of X-Force employed by Mr. Sinister. And it had characters like Scalp Hunter, which is like, who cares?
Right.
But they're definitely just using the title and maybe the piratey concept.
Right. They are sailing the seas, so to speak. Maybe they're protecting the island. Like, that's what their deal is.
Yeah. I think that that's probably a good bet.
Then we got New Mutants, which at the panel, they said that Hickman would be writing the first arc and then Ed Brisson would come on. At least that's what I heard.
Yep.
But people have been talking about them collaborating on it, and I don't know if that's true.
The first issue is written by Hickman and Brisson.
Okay.
So you have Jonathan Hickman and Ed Brisson on issue one. Issue two is written just by Jonathan Hickman. The art is by Rodriguez, and the cover arts are also by Rodriguez. This doesn't really surprise me at all, because Hickman has so publicly said that he loves these characters, and I also love the New Mutants, doesn't everyone?
Yeah.
But you've got Sunspot, Wolfsbane, Mirage, Karma, Magic, and Cypher. And then they also are bringing in Chamber and Mondo. Mondo's a weird pick. But I can see, like, this is a team crafted of characters, New Mutants characters, Claremont's New Mutants that people really, really care about. And the art is really, really interesting. The promise that they're going to be heading into space alongside the Starjammers is really, really interesting. I am really excited for this book. Probably the most excited for this book. Because when New Mutants are done right, they're done really right. And I think a lot of people have a great fondness for New Mutants as a title, like Claremont and Sienkiewicz, but also these characters.
So. But where's Strong Guy? That's what I want to know.
he's got a action figure coming out.
I know. Dude, that figure looks amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Next, and another book coming out is Fallen Angels. Are you excited for Fallen Angels?
I am. Guess who's on that?
Brian Edward Hill.
Yes. And X-23 is on this team. So.
Yes.
Interesting.
Oh, that's right. You like that character.
I like X-23. I don't like Kid Cable, so maybe they'll make that work. And this is also Quanin as Psylocke.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Braddock as Captain Britain over in Excalibur, and you have Quanin taking the name Psylocke.
Someone at Marvel said, why not both?
Yeah. I'm really, really excited for X-23, obviously. I'm really excited for Quanin to have her own story, to kind of find her own heroic bent and be Psylocke and stuff. I did not like Kid Cable in Brisson's X-Force, but I'm not going to hold that against the character itself. I think it really depends on who's writing it. We'll see how that goes. Interesting, too, that this book has absolutely nothing to do with the original Fallen Angels, which had, like,
right.
Bill the Lobster and a bunch of other weird characters on crazy adventures. This almost seems like another X-Force book.
For sure. It's going to be darker with Seizman Kudransky on art.
Yeah.
More violent, probably.
I am not the biggest fan of his work, but I'm pretty interested by the idea of the title being connected to these characters. Obviously, Brian Edward Hill picked the characters that he wanted to write, so I think he probably already has a story in mind, and anything with Laura is really, really exciting to me. I'm so, so stoked and excited that she's still a mainline character.
Right, yeah.
I was a little worried, like, with Logan returning and stuff, that was going to melt away.
So Kid Cable's on another team, too, apparently.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard this team. It's called X-Men.
I'm not
And that'll be written by Hickman with art by Lionel Wu, who's done a lot of big event books. So I have a feeling with Wu on this, they're kind of going, yep, this is the main one.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a weird team.
It's the Summers team.
It's Cyclops, right? And his hand-picked squad of mutant powerhouses. So it's literally everyone related to Cyclops. Like, you have Havoc, you have Jean, you have Vulcan, and then you have Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I saw a thing that was like, this is my brother and my sister and my wife and my brother and my wife's boyfriend.
Now, the interesting thing at the panel was when they went to reveal who's on the team, it was every single X-Men.
Yeah.
And they had said that every X-Men will be on this team. So maybe it's like a rotating cast. Maybe it's more about the X-Men in general, and it's not about just Scott doing stuff. I don't know. It's kind of a weird thing to say. And then they have a cover with very specific characters on it.
Yeah. And maybe it's going to change every arc or something like that. But it certainly seems like they're almost saying all mutants are X-Men now.
And they're on the moon.
Which has been a contentious point in the past. Not the moon.
Right, right. Everyone hates the moon. That's true.
Yeah, that's not contentious at all. Everyone hates the moon.
All right. So obviously X-Men stormed SDCC. And I think it's what everyone's talking about. Obviously with House of X just coming out this week too.
Yep.
Which we'll get to a little bit later. But yeah, the other big news from SDCC was the Eisner winners. They were all released on, I think it was it Friday night? It was, right?
Friday night, yep.
I was there. I was live tweeting that too. And a couple surprises, you know, the biggest probably being that Forrest and I had a bet and we picked who we thought would win. And can you tell the fans who won this bet?
Well, I will say that we kneecapped ourselves because we intentionally didn't choose Mr. Miracle.
That's true.
So, you know, we were like, that's probably an obvious win. Let's try and pick what would be the best win aside from that.
Right.
But we had best continuing series. The winner was Giant Days. You had chosen Immortal Hulk, and I had chosen Black Hammer. So neither of us, that's a wash. Mm-hmm. Best limited series, Eternity Girl, I chose. You chose Exit Stage Left, The Snagglepuss Chronicles. Mr. Miracle won that. Mr. Miracle was the most nominated book again. So, like, they cleaned up. Best new series, I picked Bitter Root, a fantastic book. And you picked Gideon Falls. So you won because Gideon Falls did win.
I know how to pick them.
You know how to pick them. And then we have best writer. Tom King won that, although Chip Zdarsky won for best single issue. Jeff Lemire was my choice. Again, like really leaning into how popular Black Hammer is and how much it's blown up. And I'm glad he won for Gideon Falls as well. We both picked Mitch Gerads for best penciler, and he won. We have best painter, Dustin Nguyen won for Descender. Best colorist, Matt Wilson won. Best lettering, Todd Klein won. But the biggest win is you.
Yay!
Won our bet by one book.
Which I might add, I did not even know until you told me like earlier today.
Yeah, I counted him up and I was like, oh no.
Just goes to show you. You know, we're all winners here. And including the people that won at the Eisners. It was an interesting show to cover, I have to say. They have all the talent, I would say, up front near the stage. And then they have ropes for everyone else like me.
For everyone else like me.
Yeah.
Animals.
Like, basically. And, you know, what's kind of hilarious about the ropes, too, is right over the ropes where they are is like a full bar and like all this nice food, like steak and stuff. And they're all, of course, dressed up. And behind the rope, you know, the chattel, we're all like in t-shirts and stuff, and we're all sweaty and smell because we were just at the con all day. Yeah. But I know it was a very cool experience to see the speeches because, you know, you don't normally see that stuff if you're just looking at articles. And, you know, Chip Zdarsky, I think people might have seen that because they were recording him. He was hilarious when he said more than once that he was drunk.
Yeah, he said, I'm so fucking drunk and I love this fucking community. Which, us too, Chip.
It was kind of funny to watch Tom King go up there four times.
Yeah.
And on the last time, he was just like, I didn't even design the book because it was for Vision.
The Vision reprint, yeah.
Yeah. And he just kind of stormed off. It was really quick. The hosts were really good. They had the guy from Reno 911. I forget his name now. Comedian. But they were like totally ribbing everyone who went up there and gave a speech. Like, people would go up and be up there for 20 seconds. They'd be like, have you ever been to an award show? You're supposed to be up here for like 20 minutes. And sure. and they also commented on how a lot of folks were like, I didn't even think I'd win. I didn't prepare any speech. And they were like, just lie. Just tell them you knew you'd win.
Yeah.
I would recommend going to that. It wasn't a packed house for the commoners like us, but it's an interesting experience to see it. I mean, it's the Oscars for comics, right?
Yeah. I think it's the closest we got. I did hear some pretty negative stuff about the ceremony, about speakers and stuff. There's really good breakdowns of that on the Hollywood Reporter and the Mary Sue. Like, some really inappropriate jokes were made about ICE and stuff like that. So definitely check that out for a little bit bigger context and also a good spotlight on some of the issues that are still present in the community.
Yes, the joke did not do well in the room. Everyone was like, there was a couple laughs, but it was pretty much like dead air. And the guy was like, what?
Yeah.
What? I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
There was a really passionate speech about Puerto Rico.
Yes. That speech has also been, I think it's all over Twitter and it's all over those articles as well. Really, really great speech.
I tried to write a little bit. I couldn't, he was talking so fast, I couldn't write it down exactly what he said, but I talked about it in my news piece about it. But yeah. So there were some really good speeches too. It wasn't all negative or, you know, racist.
Right. Right. So you won.
But I still won. Yes.
But you still won. What are the terms of our bet, which we never decided?
I don't know. You know, I'm going to have to think about it. I have to sleep on it.
Okay. So next episode.
Okay. Yes.
You'll have to hold me to it.
Hold me to it.
Yeah. Sure thing.
I'm going to make you... Oh, you should like draw and write a comic book about this podcast. That's what you should
do. Oh, boy. All right.
And it has to be 3 pages.
Watch me do really, really well and just take off from here.
Look at that. Yeah. Once again, I win because I started your career.
How did he draw his bald head so shiny?
You know, a career we don't need to start is Tom King and Mitch Gerads, who revealed that they're doing a new series next year with Doc Shaner entitled Strange Adventures, which is from a classic DC Comics series, I think from the, don't quote me, 50s, I think?
I have no idea. I know nothing about Adam Strange.
Yeah, it's something that they've been hyping, that if they said that if they'd win a lot of Eisners, they would tell people.
Yes, and then they got the okay from DC editorial while they were there.
Right. So, yeah, because, like, Tom won 4 Eisners and Mitch won, well, 2, I think, right? Yeah.
I think that's right, yeah. Yeah. They were the most winningest people.
I'm excited for it, mostly because I'm really a big sci-fi fan. Mm-hmm. And that book is all about, you know, spaceman fights monsters, you know, shoots monsters with a laser gun kind of thing. Or at least it was originally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're really good at getting to the root of what the character's about. And I'm sure it's interesting. They revealed 2 covers. One is like bright and shiny, right? And the other one is like weird, twisted, right?
Like graffiti that says liar and colonizer and stuff on it. So
it makes me think they're doing Mr. Miracle 2 in a sense, and that they're going to capture the internal struggle and depression, I'm sure, of this spaceman.
Yeah. Or I hope that they spin it a little bit away from what Vision and Mr. Miracle were.
Yeah.
And talk more about how society views a historical figure or something like that.
You know,
the winners write the history books type angle. I think that'll be interesting. I hope that they do that, because I don't know that I would be interested in just the same story for the third time.
Well, maybe they'll prove you wrong at the Eisners in 2021.
They probably will. Or 2020. Will. Yeah.
Actually, no, it'd be 2021, wouldn't it? Because it wouldn't be over until 2021. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they can win 2 Eisners for the same book like they did on Mr. Miracle. In our next bit of news, Robert Kirkman, yeah, you know him, the guy who canceled Walking Dead on you out of nowhere, he has no plans for a Negan spinoff, and we are happy about this, aren't we?
I'm very happy about it. I'm glad that he's kind of pulled back from that, because I know, like, the day after Walking Dead ended, I think, I saw some people saying, like, and especially, I think even he himself said, like, we've always got Negan stories to tell.
Yeah.
But he's since given an interview where he was like, no, I have no current plans for Negan. I thought about writing him into the final issue. I thought about doing some sort of spinoff idea or something like that. But like, maybe I'll come around to Negan when my career is nosediving and it's like, hey, here's more Walking Dead. But in the interim, I'm just not interested in telling that story at all. I think that's good. And I think it shows a lot of self-restraint.
Let's be honest. Image could probably continue printing spinoffs for quite a while. There's such a huge fan base.
And AMC's still going with it, so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what else is going with it? HBO is going full steam ahead with Watchmen, their TV show, written by Damon Lindelof. I think the trailer looks cool. I mean, I'm
already over it, man.
I'm excited that it's so different from the original material that I don't have to be upset that they've ruined the material.
Yeah.
You know, and we're already in a post-Doomsday Clock world where, you know, anything goes with Watchmen. They already did the prequel series. If you find Watchmen to be like the Bible of comics, they've already wiped their ass with it so many times.
Well, yeah.
It's hard to be offended by it, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm pretty unimpressed with everything I've heard about this show so far. I think it looks visually amazing. I think the trailers have been good. I love what I've seen of The Leftovers. Loss is fine. It's interesting. It's powerful. And people certainly had opinions about it. So maybe that's the same idea with Watchmen. But
sure.
There was one thing about it's a story about white supremacists killing police.
Mm.
And that rings really just disingenuous to me, because like that's almost alt reality at this point. And maybe that's the idea. But a lot of police officers in the real world are white supremacists or white supremacist aligned. So that it's a weird time for that story to come out, I think. Well, society at large is struggling with those ideas, right? With reconciling those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And then also his kind of, as you said, like they've already kind of destroyed Watchmen's history. And Alan Moore is really not happy with that and never wanted to continue Watchmen outside of the original statement that that book is. He said that he was trying to emulate the spirit of Alan Moore in making Watchmen, even though Moore didn't want it to be made at all.
Right.
He said, "I do feel the spirit of Alan Moore is a punk rock spirit, a rebellious spirit. And if you would tell Alan Moore, a teenage Moore, in 85 or 86, you're not allowed to do this because Superman's creator or Swamp Thing's creator doesn't want you to do it, he would say, fuck you, I'm doing it anyway. So I'm channeling the spirit of Alan Moore to tell Alan Moore, fuck you, I'm doing it anyway." That's just, like, not contextually or objectively true at all.
Mm-hmm.
Moore was picked by previous creators to
make Swamp Thing. Yeah.
And like, and also when he couldn't tell the stories that he wanted to tell or they were rejected, he went and told stories with public domain characters. And also, like, the punk rock spirit of Alan Moore means not making a TV show for a giant mega conglomeration that's buying up all media.
Right.
You know? So it's just kind of the actual exact opposite of the ethos, aside from the fact that you latched onto the phrasing.
Do you think Alan Moore came out and said he's retiring from comics to combat the trailer that he knew was coming?
No, I don't think so at all. He said a long time ago that this would be his last book.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's the last we'll hear of him saying negative things about this.
Right. Well, that's the end of our news segment. Next up is Top Books of Last Week, where we pick one book that we really, really liked from last week. We're only picking one this week because we have so much to say to Dennis Hopeless Hallam.
Yeah, if you've gone through the episode this far, the good stuff is coming.
It's still coming. In this segment, we talk about Comic Book Roundup a little bit. This is a Rotten Tomatoes of comics of sorts, and they always have a critic pick and a fan pick. And I heard on the grapevine that we're going to be reading out the review quote from the critic and fan who have the top score.
Because in the past we've both recognized that we haven't reviewed the book or read the book that has been highly rated. So I think a better way to do this, rather than talking around a book that we haven't read or don't know anything about or saying, yep, Immortal Hulk is back, we can give credit to other folks that are contributing to the industry and are putting their voices out there and stuff in the same way we do every week on AIPTcomics.com.
For sure.
The first critic pick is Wiccan and Divine 44 with a 9.5. This is the penultimate issue. So the last issue of Kieran Gillen and Jamie McClavey's Wiccan and Divine is 45. So this is
so
the
sad
one leading right into that. David Harth from You Don't Read Comics said, "The Wiccan and Divine 44 closes out much of the book's plot lines and does so in an emotionally affecting, perfect way. Kieran Gillen's script hits all the points it needs to hit, but saying that it takes away from the sheer artistry and majestic beauty of what is accomplished in this issue." Some high
well
praise,
said.
Certainly.
High praise. I wish I could do a Nicolas Cage accent. High praise.
The fan pick with 61 fan reviews. The most I have ever seen on Comic Book Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
This user review, the top rated 10 on July 24th, the Comic Cookbook says, "Hickman's back at Marvel and doesn't disappoint. The structure and interior design, which are found in his indie books like Black Monday Murders and East of West, work beautifully in this X-book. I get the sense that Hickman will be able to go nuts and truly make the X-line significant and worth reading again. I'm so pleased to see rising star Pepe Larraz on this high-profile book, and it complements Hickman's writing. Can't wait for more, and is already in the running to be one of my favorite series of the year."
Nice.
We also both loved House of X.
We did. We read it and then talked about it almost immediately, I think, because
yes,
we were so excited about it.
Yeah, I'm equally excited for Powers of 10. We were both going to pick House of X this week, so we just decided not to. Kind of got a stalemate going on. I also feel that I was going to pick House of X, but I don't think I could talk about it anywhere near as well as I've seen some other folks do on the internet. Folks should definitely go check out our reviewer Ritesh Babu's review on AIPTcomics.com. Also, Chris Edelman and Robert Secundus wrote a piece for Xavier Files, xavierfiles.com, the host of the Battle of the Atom podcast, where they did this really, really impressive, deeply profound, well thought out, informative annotation of every single page of the first issue. It's staggering. I mean, it's got to be pushing like 18,000 words. There's a ton of references to religion and biology and previous X-Men books and stuff that they picked out, and I was really flabbergasted, impressed, blown away by it.
Yeah,
and they're
going to
be doing that for every issue.
They did that in 2 days.
Yeah,
a lot.
To see a work of that scale and insight come out the same week as the book is mind-blowing to me.
There's like two or three other people out there who were going to do it, but they needed more time, and they're like, damn it!
Yeah, yeah. So massive, massive credit to those guys. It's really amazing.
It's an exciting time
to
be an
X-Men fan. And I learned a lot of words.
There's big words in there.
Yeah.
Nice. This happens a couple times every decade, maybe. Maybe every 2 decades, mm-hmm. I feel like. Mm-hmm. Like, Spider-Man's had a revolution or two in his time. Batman, obviously, here and there. But this is, it feels bigger because there's so many characters and there's so much history to the X-Men.
I think knowing that six, like we talked about before, six books are going to come out of this, and that's only the first wave. Well, you have Jordan D. White saying, Jonathan Hickman pitched me a story that will last 30 years of Marvel publishing. Like,
we'll
it won't actually last that long, but the idea that he's crafted something that could go for that long, mission statements like that hardly ever come out anymore.
It got me excited too. I got to talk to him. If you go to aiptcomics.com, you can read the interview I did with him and three other press sites. But I asked him about his sci-fi and how you know, in depth it goes, mm-hmm. with like East of West and other things, and he made a joke out of it, like, you think? But he basically said there's a huge sci-fi idea that only he could do that's coming down the pike. We don't know when. He didn't say when. It's not soon. And Jordan was there next to him, nodding, going, yep, yep, yep. And I'm really pumped for that. I love the sci-fi element. And the sci-fi feel of House of X is so huge. And that's what's really selling me. I've never been super attached to X-Men characters. I've obviously read them for my whole life. But it's that element mixed with the superhero-dom and the mutant element that's got me excited. But you know what? We're going to talk about House of X and Powers of 10 a lot more probably next week.
Yeah, I think after Powers of 10 comes out next week, we're going to have a dedicated segment on the show about it.
For sure. But let's get to our picks. Forrest, what was your favorite book of last week that's not House of X?
My favorite book was History of the Marvel Universe, number 1, written by Mark Waid with art by Javier Rodriguez. I very, very sincerely hope that Marvel puts out some sort of collected edition, maybe even an oversized hardcover edition of all of these issues. Javier Rodriguez's art is unspeakably, unquantifiably, unmeasurably amazing. And then I also really, really like the framing method that Mark Waid has selected for telling this story. It's Mr. Fantastic and Galactus at the end of the universe. They're the only two people left in all of creation. And Richard asks Galactus to recount the history of their entire universe because he wants to remember it before they die, basically. So Galactus, I love the idea of a character within the universe telling the history of the universe, which isn't to say that there's any worries about like a unreliable narrator or anything like that in this. I think that it's all pretty much exactly what you would expect, and it's true, honest history, including like secrets and stuff that I've never heard before. But it doesn't read like a Wikipedia page. It's delivered in a much more like poetic, conversational, nuanced delivery, given that Galactus is narrating all of it. And then to see Javier Rodriguez drawing like the birth of the Celestials and the Shi'ar and the Kree and the Skrull and like the first of vampire, K'thon, Set, Odin, all that stuff, like, it is an artistic mission statement, the likes of which I have never seen in my entire life. Yeah. What was your number one pick?
My number one pick that wasn't House of X is you know what? It's almost offensive to say that, isn't it? My number one pick is Batman Curse of the White Knight, book one, and it's a DC Black Label book from Sean Murphy and colorist Matt Hollingsworth. Relation?
Yes, there is.
Oh my gosh. Well, look at that. We have a direct connection to this book.
I made it.
So yeah, you did in some way, sort of. So I was really on board for White Knight. This is basically a follow-up to that, where Joker was basically taking pills to make himself normal, a well-adjusted and a very intelligent man, not a crazy psychopath.
Yes, well, Batman himself was getting more increasingly scary and violent. And
right. Yeah. And this, it's interesting. It makes reference to that, but only briefly. It's really its own story.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I was a little worried about that. I haven't read Curse of White Knight in a while, and I was like, it's such a high barrier to entry, but it's good to know that it may not read like that.
I mean, the book starts in, let me see the year, 1685 in Arkham Manor, and there's a guy who looks kind of like he's trying to be, who's that, the Zorro type.
Mm.
He's got a very thin sword, and he's doing some swashbuckling. It looks like he might be fighting some maniac who could be a vampire. I think he is. And I'm pretty sure this is probably Bruce's like great-great-grandfather. And the story then quickly moves to Joker, who makes reference to the last story. But he's going down into this weird, deep part of Arkham Asylum that never has anyone there. And there's a deep, dark secret down there. So it's linking back to ancient history. Obviously, this is all Elseworlds. It's not canon, but it doesn't matter. That makes it more fun because we don't know what's going to happen. But we've already got vampires, an ancient part of the Arkham Asylum that we've never seen. And that's like the first three pages.
Yeah.
So it's immediately caught my interest. Clearly, Sean Murphy's not trying to ride the coattails of the last series. He's doing a whole new story and catching your interest and making it good on its own bearing. There's also Azrael, who's pops up into this. I don't want to spoil it. He's obviously going to be a big part of the narrative.
Interesting pick, too. Like, Azrael is not the character I go to for that kind of stuff, but I'm interested on the take.
There's a religious connection, I think. If you look at the first few pages, and if you look closely, there's a dude with a cross, and they're fighting a vampire, right?
Okay.
And then cut to 400 or 500 years later, we can see that there's probably still a battle of vampires in Gotham. I don't know, maybe. But it's a really exciting first issue, and obviously Sean Murphy and Matt Hollingsworth's art is just off the charts, really, really good. You just don't see this style and this quality of art matched together so often. All right, and our next segment, top books for next week, we're going to talk about the number one book we're looking forward to out next week. And I want to go first.
Go for it.
Is that cool? Batman Last Night on Earth number 2 by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. This is my number one pick to look forward to because I got really jazzed when I heard Scott talk about this book specifically at the DC Black Label panel. There's some wild ideas at work here. I mean, it's clearly an Elseworlds tale because there is flash tornadoes. Like, the old flashes are all, like, turned into tornadoes.
Oh, Speed Force tornadoes? Yeah, and I heard about that.
And then I flip through it because we get the books early, and there's some crazy cool fantasy ideas that are going on that it's clear that these creators, Capullo and Snyder, can just kind of do what they want, and they're just doing like a remix on superhero stuff in this crazy Armageddon future where heroes and villains aren't who they are anymore. And the book looks gorgeous. I know some people they weren't super jazzed for number one, but I feel like number two might change their minds.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I think anything Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo does well. And I think that they have a very strong intentionality to their craft and the stories that they want to tell and everything. And Snyder has kind of pitched this as like his definitive word on Batman, saying like, if you show the origin of a character and their life and their highs and lows and then their death. And he's not saying whether or not they're killing Batman at the end of this, but just kind of like the end of their story.
Right.
That you own a version of that character. And it's obvious to me that he's been thinking about this and writing to this for a very long time. So I think that that's really cool.
Yeah, he was saying Grant Morrison gave him that idea told him about that.
Morrison does write like that as well and has spoken about it before. Yeah.
Also, Joker is a head in a lantern, and it's a very good comedic take on Joker because he's like, There's a panel that was leaked. Well, not leaked, but it was revealed by the creators earlier today, I think. And he's like, can I be Robin now? And it's like, okay, this is definitely having fun.
Yeah.
What's your number one pick for next week?
My number one pick for next week is, I don't even want to joke about Hoxus Poxus anymore. They're so good. yeah. My number one pick is Powers of 10, number one, written by Jonathan Hickman with art by Arby Silva. First of all, Hickman's picks for these books, Arby Silva and Pepe Larraz for the art, astounding, fantastic choices. There's a Powers of 10 and House of X preview issue, a free issue over on Comixology, and like the interior art on Powers of 10 is amazing. It has this much more different, dispassionate, cold sci-fi feel compared to the kind of warm, maybe even overly friendly House of X feel. And the story is taking place 100 years in the future. Hickman has said that every issue of them that come out, because they're telling a kind of symbiotic story every other week, up to 12 issues, is going to recontextualize the previous issue. So just knowing that there's a 100-year jump here that's going to tell us more about what happened or is happening in House of X is really, really exciting. There's some characters that look like amalgamations of other characters. You have a Rasputin character who looks a little bit like Danny Moonstar and Magic, and then you have another character, Priest, who looks like he's basically like a red Nightcrawler and stuff. There's a lot of stuff in House of X that seems very like medical and biological manipulation, and there's even an insinuation that Omega level mutants are almost like a caste system unto themselves. The Omega level mutants need to be protected, however possible, to preserve the state, is what it says. Which is, I think, we're going to see more and more this development of kind of a caste system or mutants that are being bred or experimented on for very specific purposes. The way that House of X feels really, really hopeful, even the previews of this issue feel quite the opposite. And I'm really, really excited for this kind of like slow burn horror story almost that's happening.
Right. And how it's going to change your mind, or not change your mind, but change your perspective on House of X.
Yeah. A really, really stunning, powerful mission statement. I'm actually going to be writing a piece for the site about how Jonathan Hickman is a master level world builder and has kind of also gamified world building for fans and for himself. So
you know what, when I was interviewing him, I should have asked him if he plays D&D or
yeah,
has
yeah.
created his own world and play in that. I don't know.
I
wouldn't be surprised if he said he did.
I mean, it's so strong that it almost makes me want to, like, all his charts and maps and everything. I think
I know, right?
Do it relatively easy. So
just adds a whole other layer to it that most creators don't do.
Yeah.
Next up, last segment before we talk to Dennis Hopeless Hallam. Judging by the cover, Junior, where we talk a little bit about cover art that we really, really like coming out this next Wednesday. This is our chance to just mimic Eric Klein's weekly Judging by the Cover column and give our love to a cover. What is your favorite cover art out next week?
My favorite cover out is for Stranger Things 6, number 3, a poorly titled book with fantastic art and writing, actually. This is the cover by Kasper Weijengaard. It is a person playing arcade machines. One says Savage Paradise. The other says Fear Void. And one says, I think, Dead Coffins or Death Coffins. Mm-hmm. There's a really great, fantastic, obviously nostalgic pink glow hitting them. They're silhouetted. There's a lot of like dilapidation and like spider webs or growth or something coming out of these broken arcade machines and all over the ground, and then right above them you have the disgusting body horror open flower mouth of the Demogorgon from the first season of the show, kind of crouched in a animalistic hunter jumping on prey pose. It looks like almost like its feet are like embedded in the wall and it's crouching down, these clawed hands over the top of the arcade machines, almost ready to put this person's head right into its open mouth. And the way that the glow of the arcade machine covers or screens kind of fades away towards the top of the cover, like the Demogorgon almost acts as a barrier to all the light on the cover. Really, really fantastic single scene storytelling. So I really like it a lot.
Nice. I reviewed the first two issues, and it's a pretty decent prequel. Jody Hauser's doing a good job. It doesn't obviously reveal anything very new because it's, you know, not Dark Horse IP, but she's doing a really good job with the prequel story, I think.
Yeah. I think that she is the best franchise writer in comics. Star Wars, Stranger Things, some of the other stuff she's written. I love it. I also really love Renew Your Vows, so she's got me hooked.
She's all over the place. She's one of the hardest working writers out there, I think.
Yeah. I'm excited for her Critical Role comic as well.
Yes, that's outstanding.
I knew there was another one. Yep.
So my cover, my favorite cover out next week is Death's Head number one by Nick Roche. You know, I don't really know Death's Head that well, but I do know this cover is pretty freaking rad because he's basically shredding on some sort of alien guitar and there are punk rockers right below him and he's like got his foot on the, what do you call that? Like a subwoofer or something? I don't even know. What is that thing? Amp. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And on the amp, it says Death's Head. And he's just leaning down on them and shredding at them. And they're throwing beer bottles at him as they smash against him. There's a really good depth of field here where you have the people in front, then you've got Death's Head, and then behind him, there's a lot of great detail with the posters on the wall and the lights up on the ceiling because we're looking up at him. And it's just badass cover. I have a feeling this cover is going to sell books. If you go to AIPTComics.com, you can see these covers. Or you actually, if you look at the Simplecast post, you can see these two covers right there in the Simplecast icon, or the icon for this post.
Yeah, I think if you're listening on Spotify, too, you should see episode-specific art. So Dave always does a really, really fantastic job of getting the cover arts onto the episode and onto the AIPT Comics post.
Right, because we know you're listening and you can't see, but we're trying our best to show you. Because you know what? This is a comics podcast, and we have to honor the art because it's 50% of the story.
If not more sometimes. Yeah.
So true, so true.
Yeah.
All right. So, are you guys ready for Dennis Hopeless Hallam?
I am.
We have so many good questions.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Dennis.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dennis, you've written Spider-Woman, WWE comics at Boom. You just came off of Star Wars Vader Dark Visions, and you're currently writing Spider-Man City at War. You've got a lot going on, and you've got your fingers in so many pots.
Yeah, lately, it seems like the pots get weirder and weirder as my career goes along, but it's really fun. For a long time, all I did was write two superhero books at a time, and now it seems like I am finally doing other things.
Which is great. I mean, so we wanted to ask you, for Spider-Man Month, we've had, I don't even know how many articles for us, like 50 articles now?
50 plus, yeah.
So in honor of Spider Month, we want to just right at the top ask you, why do you like writing Spider-Man?
You know, what's weird about me and Spider-Man, I was not the hugest Spider-Man fan growing up, which I know is blasphemy. I know most people like Spider-Man's their guy.
Yeah, get him out of here, Dave.
Yeah, for whatever reason, I was more of an X-Men kid, and Spider-Man was the character that everybody else loved. Mm-hmm. What's weird about it is that I've always enjoyed writing him. Like, he showed up in my Spider-Woman run at the beginning, and I've written him a couple times in other things, and he's always really easy. Like, his voice is really easy for me for whatever reason. Like, what I do works really well with Spider-Man, and I've always had a good time writing him, but I never wanted that job for some reason. I realize these are weird things to say as a comic book writer, but it is an absolute blast. Like, I took the job because it seemed challenging and it was interesting, and I love Bill Roseman, who is the story guy over at Marvel Games and used to be my Avengers Arena editor.
And I love that book, by the way, Arena.
Thank you. And yeah, they wanted to do an adaptation of the Spider-Man PS4 game. And I thought, well, I love Bill, and I've liked writing Spider-Man in the past, so we'll give it a shot. And it turns out Spider-Man is really natural for my writer voice. He is an absolute blast to write, and he's a different kind of character than what I normally do. So I like writing Spider-Man because I didn't expect to, I think.
Nice. Good answer.
So knowing that you don't necessarily have the same history with it as a lot of people do, like definitely for me growing up, I was like, I really like Spider-Man. Everyone else likes X-Men. So I totally get that. Do you have any favorite Spider-Man stories or ones that stand out or ones where you maybe saw that voice that you liked for the first time?
I got a big kick out of the Superior Spider-Man stuff because Doc Ock is a kind of character that I really enjoy writing and that I can wrap my mind around. So I like villains who are gray. Like I like villains that you can understand their motivation and their and you know they take the wrong path but you get why. And Otto lines right up with that. So I enjoyed the hell out of that. And then like I really liked Maximum Carnage back in the day.
Yeah, man. At least you have good taste in the very few you like.
But no, I mean, I've always enjoyed Spider-Man stories that I read. He just wasn't my guy. Like, Guy Gardner was my favorite superhero growing up, if it gives you an indication of what I like.
Nice, that's funny. Have you gotten to write Guy Gardner at all?
No, I have done one job for DC.
Oh.
And it, because of things that happened in other books, it didn't even get drawn. Like, they took a left turn in what they were doing with the character I was writing right after I did my basically tryout issue, and they were like, "Love what you did, but no one's ever gonna see this."
Oh, that's a bummer.
I didn't write a DC book once, but
yeah, that's something at least.
Yeah.
So did you get resources from Sony as far as setting yourself you up for success with City at War?
Yeah, it was an interesting job because there's so much story in the game. They wanted me to, you know, to add stuff and to adapt it. As you know, if you were taking a novel and turning it into a movie, you'd have some creative license, and they wanted me to do that. But unlike most comic projects where you know, you have to plot 6 issues worth of story, I had like 15 issues worth of game story that I then had to, you know, hone down into something that would work in the 6 issues of City at War. And so we added some stuff and we changed things and merged things, but largely it was adapting that plot. And they were awesome with that. They gave me a 3-hour movie that was all the cutscenes edited together into a movie.
Oh, cool.
That is cool.
I'm not a great gamer. I have the game and I can do the part where you swing through the city and show my kids are cool. Show them how to do that. But mostly when I just watch my girlfriend play because she knows how. Mm-hmm. So it was nice to get all the story beats in the cutscenes. And yeah, they've been really great with just, you know, this is the motivation for it, for the different things, and all of their original planning documents I got. So they've been really awesome. But without being, you know, they want me to do my own thing, and they've given the Marvel editorial team I'm working with a lot of rope, and they're happy, I think.
Have you talked to Christos Gage about that at all? I know he wrote some of the game.
I've gotten a lot of support from Christos Gage on like Twitter and stuff. Like, I feel like the game's story team is really happy with what I've been doing. And Christos Gage wrote Avengers Academy right before I did Arena, so I killed all the
characters. Oh, jeez.
No, yeah, we talked back then, so I love Christos, but not a lot of direct stuff. He just like pats on the back, and he's happy with what we're doing, and like, congratulated me when I got the job.
That's cool.
So I think I've played the game and read a bunch of Spider-Man comics and all that stuff, and I think the game reverse Spidey has a slightly different voice from OG Peter Parker, and so does Spider-Woman, obviously. Yeah. Do you approach the minds of characters that are kind of within arm's length of each other differently? How do you make them seem like they're all part of the same universe, but develop a voice individually for them?
Voice is where I start in storytelling. Like, I'm not a huge plot guy. That part for me is the work. Finding the character, getting their head, figuring out their motivations, and figuring out what they sound like is what I love. Like, that's my favorite part of storytelling. So yeah, like I agree with you. I think the video game version of Peter is slightly different from what we normally see in the comics, and his world is slightly different. His relationship with like Otto Octavius obviously is crazy different. And so getting that down is really important, especially because there's a lot of great versions of Peter Parker out there right now. You know, when I started working on this, Into the Spider-Verse had just come out, and we got Peter B. Parker, who's one of the greatest versions, but also not exactly the same as the game or the comic version. So for me, it's just a matter of who is this person? How do they talk? What do they sound like? Where are they coming from? And then once I have that, I can usually hear it in my head And so when I go to like a scene, I know what the conversation's about, and I let the characters have the conversation in my head, and then write that out. It's a little bit different with the adapting, because some of those lines, those fantastic lines, are straight from the game, and I want to make sure those are in there.
Right.
But then when I'm adding stuff or, you know, changing stuff, combining stuff, I want to make sure it all is consistent and it's the same Peter you know from the game.
So with Spider-Man Velocity, they're giving you even more rope, right? Because you get to write your own PS4 Gamerverse Spider-Man now. And that comes out August 5th.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that series?
Yeah. I mean, that one of the main reasons I took the job is that they said, we want to build a Gamerverse so that this becomes another universe that we tell comic book stories in.
My God, you're getting your own Ultimate Universe.
Exactly. And, you know, as challenging as it is to adapt something that's so beloved, and you know, to take a video game amount of story and fit it into a comic, being able to write a Spider-Man that nobody else can touch for the time being is pretty awesome. I get to, in Velocity, we basically, the only prompt we were given was explain the Velocity suit. Like, why did Peter build the Velocity suit from the game, which is like the speed suit, essentially? And what is the backstory? What was he up to? What adventure was he on? Why did he build this? So we got to create that story and flesh it out and then just tell it soup to nuts. And I wanted to do something a little bit off kilter with it and take Spider-Man in an interesting direction. And I also really wanted it to deal with his relationship with Mary Jane, which is one of my favorite things in the game. So what we came up with essentially is Mary Jane Watson and Ben Urich are investigating what appears to be hauntings in New York City. Ooh. And Spider-Man is a man of science and doesn't believe in ghosts, so he thinks that's ridiculous and wants to get to the bottom of it. And that is sort of the jumping off point for the story that leads him to eventually build a speed suit.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Does it take place around the same time, or is it further into the game future?
It takes place after, at least the relationship that Peter and Mary Jane had takes place after that in the game, like the end of the game story, because of where they're at. And obviously the Velocity suit is in the game, so we kind of have to fudge that a little bit. But yeah, it takes place after the game.
And are you going to be getting a Hasbro Marvel Legends Spider-Man Velocity, or do you already have one action figure?
I saw the pictures of all the different suits. I'm not sure if it was that line, but they had in San Diego, people were taking pictures of all of the
different. Yes, they're so good.
And, yeah, they're gorgeous. I love the Velocity suit. I have spent a lot of time thinking about the Velocity suit. I'm starting to get a gorgeous art with the Velocity suit, so I might just.
Do you have a favorite Spider-Man villain or one that's your favorite to write?
My favorite, I love the game Doc Ock. Writing Doc Ock in City War is really fun. But my favorite, and maybe just because I'm from Missouri, but I love Cletus Cassidy. I really like
him. Oh, yeah.
I know that sounds like a Marvel shill because Carnage event is happening right now. Yeah. But I've always loved that hillbilly serial killer vibe. I think.
Nice. Do you have what is your proudest contribution to the Spider-Man mythos?
Oh, God, that's a great question. I mean, if you count my Spider-Woman run, it is definitely Porcupine.
Porcupine,
rehabilitating him, creating a relationship. That family that we created in Spider-Woman is really important to me. But also, Porcupine is a character that was just a stupid-looking suit for a lot of years. And that is why I chose him. I put him in Avengers Arena because the suit is awesome a couple of different times. And then randomly decided to throw him in an early issue of Spider-Woman. And now I think I've written more Porcupine than anyone else by a country mile. So I think nice.
Put it on your LinkedIn.
There you go.
Speaking of Spider-Woman, and I was just rereading it on Marvel Unlimited like last night. It's such a good series.
Thank you.
Do you have any ideas that you would like to explore again with Jessica or with her son or anything like that? Did those characters kind of live in your head still?
100%. And it's one of my favorite things I've ever done. It's definitely my favorite work for hire I have done until stuff I'm working on currently. But, you know, I did it for like 3 years, and I, you know, we wrote Jessica and changed Jessica and grew Jessica and then moved on, and other people have done great things with her since. And so, you know, I'm not, never say never. I love writing her. I'll probably put her as a guest star in 1,000 different things going forward. But I don't know that the world needs another Dennis Hopeless, Dennis Hallam, Jessica Drew story right now. Because I told it, you know, we got to end that story on a great beat. We got to wrap everything up and do it the way we wanted to do it. And I mean, I didn't think any of those pitches would go. I thought they would tell me no about the pregnancy and Porcupine and everything we did. And they didn't. And people love it. And so, yeah, I think I kind of did that, you know?
But sure. Maybe the Game Reverse can get a version.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's one of the fun things about this is I get to create the Game Reverse version of things. Like, ooh, we got to create the Swarm.
Yes, that was really cool. Awesome. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. He shows up more in Velocity. And yeah, that was super fun because if it's not in the game, it didn't exist before we do it. And then, you know, yes, the artists get to design it. It's great.
That's so cool.
So one of the things they talked about at the San Diego Comic-Con panel, the Spider-Man panel, was that they're putting fan-made Spider-Sonas into the Spider-Verse book that's coming out. As a writer, have you ever thought about your own Spider-Sona, name, suit, powers, anything like that?
I mean, Jessica Drew is probably my Spider-Sona, as weird as that is, because she is the character. It's funny. There's a picture of me from years ago that got used next to a picture of Porcupine, and somewhere online, and people were suggesting that Roger is a self-insert because this one drawing of him sort of looked like this old photo of me, which was hilarious to me because Roger is the dude from Big Lebowski in my head. Ooh. That's what he sounds like, and that's nice. Where he's coming from. And ooh, Jessica Drew is me. Like, everything I wrote for Jessica is what I would say and how my personality works. Mm. So I really found that amusing. So yeah, like, I really think my version of Jessica Drew is my Spider-Sona.
That's cool. I mean, I think that speaks to why the book feels so organic and natural. I was rereading it last night and all the stuff with the Skrulls and the way she's handling that situation. I was like, this feels so much like a real person put into a ridiculous situation. Mm. Right. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, the best thing about Jessica is that she's exasperated because she's impatient and has a short fuse, but she's a very good person. So she always wants the best. She just might be yelling at you while she's helping you. That makes any sense.
Sure.
Which maybe came from, you know, having small children when I was writing it. I feel that frustration all the time. But yeah, she's a very, very good person with very well-meaning intentions. But she might bark at you a little bit while she's helping.
With your work on Infinity Warps and Arachnite, how much of a hand did you have in developing that character's backstory and that mashup itself?
That was a really weird job. Another writer was supposed to do that, and at the 11th and a half hour, couldn't. And I was available because the schedule was weird on something, and I just had an availability. So I wrote both of those issues in like 2 weeks after I said yes.
Oh wow.
So I had like plenty of time to script it, but it all had to be figured out super fast. So Jordan White and I like hashed it out on the phone when he offered me the job, and then I knocked it out really quick. So I'm really happy with how it turned out, and it was a lot of fun. But that was a job where I had very little time to think ahead of time. And so it just kind of a happy accident that it turned out well. Usually you have a lot more lead time than that.
For sure, yeah. Jordan's actually been on this podcast before.
He is a delight.
He's very nice, yeah. We had a lot of fun with him.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a Mount Rushmore of comics artists that you'd like to work with? Like, are there comics artists whose books you really appreciate or a specific aesthetic you'd like to attach to one of your scripts or an idea that lives in your head?
I mean, there's like a billion of them. Mostly I would like to work with a bunch of my friends. You know, like I'm good friends with Jason Latour. And Jason writes more than he draws these days and is always really booked. Or like Tony Moore is a good friend of mine. I'd love to work with him. And so just because I came into comics working with friends. Kevin Mellon drew my first two books, and he was like my good friend that I talked to every day. And it was really fun to have that, like, my best friend is drawing this thing we just discussed relationship. Marvel doesn't really work like that. I've been at Marvel largely for my entire career. So oftentimes, you know, I've never even met the artist that I'm working with. And I've been really lucky and love my collaborators and have become friends with my collaborators from afar working with them. But yeah, my Mount Rushmore would probably be like all of my super crazy talented friends that I've never gotten to work with.
Nice. Yeah, Scott Snyder was talking about that at San Diego Comic-Con. Like, his job is so much more fun when he gets to write with his writing partners like James Tinian and Josh Williamson.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm doing Sea of Stars with Jason Aaron right now. And like, we talked about working together for years before he came up with something. And yeah, it's just a very different thing to hop on the phone with someone you know super well and toss ideas back and forth. And then, you know, tell Stephen Green to make it and Rico Renzi to make it gorgeous. And they do. So yeah, there's like two ways to make comics and they both work really well. But yeah, there's an intimacy to working with your friends that you don't necessarily get on work for hire always.
It's funny, on our sheet here, we have, what's it like to write, what's the writing process like with Jason Aaron? And you're already getting into that.
You want me to answer it now?
Yeah.
Yeah, go for it.
CSRs is a weird project because it was born out of necessity when we saw how brilliant Stephen Green is. Jason had met him before though, I think, but I met Stephen Green at the Kansas City Comic Show a couple years ago and his art was just fantastic and he didn't know it and it was obvious and he only had, I think he had like half of a Hellboy issue or something left to draw and didn't know what he was going to do next. And so I went and got Jason and said, okay, well, I found the artist and we need something for him right now because I don't want someone else to snatch him up. And so we went and pitched him on the idea of working together. And then now it was our job to come up with a concept. And Jason's one of my favorite comic book writers. I love his work, but his ideas never make any sense to me whenever he's explaining them. But like before I read the book, like our minds just work completely differently and vice versa. Like whenever I pitch him stuff, he'll just kind of like, all right. And then we like what each other come up with. So anytime we would try to come up with a concept, we couldn't get on the same page. And eventually he had this crazy Kirby space ocean little boy swimming through the stars thing that I couldn't wrap my mind around. And I really wanted to tell the story of like a down on his luck ice road trucker whose kid goes missing and like how terrifying it is as a parent to watch your kid in peril when your kid doesn't understand the stakes. And we just like sort of smashed those two things together like a Reese's peanut butter cup.
Nice.
And told Steven to do them at the same time. And that, I mean, it turns out that was a really interesting idea because it is two very different stories being told at the same time in the same location and the same artist. And it also makes it so that our collaboration is a little bit different. Like we sit down together and plot out the whole arc and then kind of crack it into loose issues. And then Jason goes and writes an adventure story with a little boy with weird powers, like swimming through the stars and talking to space animals. And I go and write The Road by Cormac McCarthy with the trying desperately to find his kid in the most terrifying situations possible. And then we interlace them sort of. So like Jason wrote most of the first issue. I wrote the last few pages that are with the dad once they get separated. And then the second issue is the opposite where it's mostly the dad and it's all me. And then from there on, it's like 50-50, 10 pages of Gil, 10 pages of Caden, and we just split it up. That's awesome. I get fully formed scenes that I didn't know what they were going to be from Jason for his half and vice versa. And then as long as we stay on the basic plot, it works out great.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. That's a process I've never heard of.
I wouldn't work with most things. It'd be insane with most things because you would need to step a little bit better. But because it is a story told from two very different perspectives is kind of the hook. It makes sense that way.
You've kind of already said it, but what would the elevator pitch be for this book?
It's like Finding Nemo meets The Road in space.
I love that. Just add in space onto things and it just immediately brings you there.
The space in the book is a lot like old science fiction novels from before that we understood what space was really like before anyone went to space. like C.S. Lewis's space trilogy,
where
actual space is nothing like the space in the book. Like it's more in a mystical ocean than it is, you know, an anti-gravity, real hard sci-fi space. So it makes it all the more terrifying for Gil and all the more exciting for Kate.
That's cool. So that's the end of our question portion. We wanted to move on to a segment where we call Super Fight, which is where, because it's Spider-Man month or Spider month, we're taking Spider-Man, we're pitting him against, it's a DC character, right, Forrest?
Yeah, I'll pull up a DC character.
And then there's a game actually called Super Fight. It's actually produced by Skybound, where it's just a random thing for them to compete in. So it's not like who's the strongest. It's like, I'm going to randomly just pull one and not. This isn't our card. Good old fashioned pistol duel, like something like that. Like who would be better at that? So it's going to be Spider-Man, and then Force is going to pull a DC character.
Martian Manhunter.
Oh my God. All right. and their competition, I just pulled this, is Fastest Lumberjack.
Oh.
So now we're just going to discuss this and hash it out. Who would be the fastest lumberjack, Spider-Man or Martian Manhunter? Does anyone have any strong feelings about this one?
Well, have you ever watched one of those lumberjack competitions?
I have.
No.
There's a bunch of different things. Like saw the fastest sawing and like the quickest up the pole and all this stuff. And
it's intense.
I feel like in different categories of it, there would be an obvious winner. Like Spider-Man would be up that pole faster than anybody.
Ooh,
like,
that's true.
The climbing aspect, I think Spider-Man has.
Although Martian Manhunter can fly, right? So is that cheating though? I don't know.
That's cheating. I think.
Yeah, you have to follow. Yeah, absolutely have to follow the strict rules of the lumberjack games. But yeah, Martian Manhunter has to be way stronger, right? So any of the strength-based competitions or
that's true.
Maybe I don't know. Like, what is this? What is speed like with green Martians? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't think he's... usually when you see him speeding around, it's because he's flying really fast.
Right.
You're right, though. Spider-Man has, like, more skill at climbing things. He also has his own strength, right?
He's strong.
For sure, yeah. As strong as a Martian man, though, that's something else entirely.
I guess here's a question. Who's better with tools, right? Because you've got the axe, you might have a chainsaw in the competition. And I can't think of either of them really using tools very often.
No, I mean, Spider-Man's more limber.
That's true.
And Martian Manhunter can shapeshift. So, like, how would that come out?
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking, like, is that also disqualified?
But that's interesting.
Then it's like, how do you get Spidey to not use his powers, right?
Right. I mean, I guess
they have to be able to use their... I feel like it's like a normal athlete. As long as they are following the rules of the game, their gifts can be utilized, right? But you can't just punch through the tree as opposed to hacking at it with an axe because that is not falling. Right?
But then can Spider-Man use his webs? Because then he could like use the webs to grab more, like maybe he could like jump ahead or pull something to him.
Can he pull trees down with his webs?
Ooh, I've never seen him do that actually.
I think no webs, but definitely the stickiness of his hands to get up the tree, right?
Interesting. Okay.
This is a tough one. I mean, I would actually, maybe I'd actually argue that they have a similar strength. Because, I mean, Martian Manhunter isn't as strong as, like, Superman, but he is strong.
Yeah, it's weird. Spider-Man, I feel like Spider-Man is very strong, but because there are, like, brute characters in the Marvel Universe, we don't think of him as being particularly strong.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back to that like famous picture of the Master Planner trilogy where he's like lifting up tons of concrete, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
and then if Aunt May is being dangled over like a fire, I mean, he's going to go way harder, faster.
Contest. Yeah.
Right? So
this is a ridiculous lumberjack competition.
You know, it's all the more interesting with the old women dangling over fire. Oh my God, and that fire would actually motivate Martian Manhunter, right? Because that's his one weakness.
That's true. So if you just lock... I feel like we're more talking about the rules of a superhero lumberjack competition than we are who would win it.
You're right. I'm going to go Spider-Man.
I think without the webs, I would give it to Martian Manhunter.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I think I'd go Spider-Man because I think he's more limber. Yeah. Also, I think he would care more. I feel like Martian Manhunter would have no actual interest. Like if you forced him to participate, he would do it.
You're so right. Because, I mean, he's not, interested in human ways like this. I mean, it's a waste of time for him. Spider-Man maybe wants that fame. At least
I can imagine Peter watching the lumberjack competition on TV when working on some sort of invention, and so he would be enthusiastic about attempting this. Whereas Martian Manhunter didn't care.
I like that. I like that take.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
All right, Spider-Man wins.
I feel
wins.
Bad about being the Spider-Month editor and picking Martian Manhunter now.
It happens to the best of us. Okay, Dennis, in the last segment, off-topic, top shelf, we're just going to ask you what you're into right now that's not comic-related, be it movies, music, food, anything like that.
Let's see. I just rewatched Deadwood. My girlfriend hadn't seen Deadwood, so we rewatched Deadwood, and then we watched the movie last night, and that was fascinating, mainly because they let the actors look as old as they would in the Old West at their current age, which was fascinating. And I'm a dialogue guy, so I've always loved Deadwood, like the weird, dirty Shakespeare of it. It was really fun. So I have been really into that, I guess. What else? I'm a Veronica Mars fan, so I'm thrilled that there's
Veronica Mars. Yeah, I just
Veronica
finished
Mars.
That.
Yeah. I'm only 3 episodes in, but it is 1,000 times more effective than that movie was. So,
yes. Yeah, it's a lot better.
You know what? I was just discussing this with my girlfriend, but like, I think television characters and television situations need a television amount of space to work. And if you try to do that with that size of cast and that kind of world in 2 hours, it's just going to be disappointing. You know, like, it's either going to not have everybody in it, or everybody's going to be in it and most people aren't going to have enough to do. And the Deadwood movie suffers from that a little bit. And Veronica Mars movie was... it was just like back-to-back fan service of every character getting a second. It's great to see this. It's great to see Neptune with some room to breathe again.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good
I think
picks.
That makes sense. And I also can see like Veronica Mars is very dialogue-driven. So I'm getting a sense of your tastes at large, and that totally makes sense to me.
So that's the end of our show. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being on the show, Dennis. And if you like the show, please subscribe and like. And Dennis, you can too if you want. I don't know.
If you want.
The bad thing about me and podcasts is that I'm not supposed to be listening to things when I'm on my computer. I'm supposed to be typing. Which is sad, because when I had a day job, I was a podcast man. But I'll check it out.
I'm really looking forward to Velocity. I can't wait.
I think I like it a lot. It is, like the all new content of it and the amount of freedom we've got. It's really fun.
Very cool. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
And that's the end of the show.
Woo!
Thanks again, Dennis.
Sure. Sorry I talk so fast.